Steve, thanks very much. If we could go back in time just 1 week, we had Tom Mikaitis on, and our intention at the time was to talk about what's going on in North Korea, but there were so many other things to chat about that we kind of got lost and swept up in time, and Tom's been kind enough to rejoin us today so we can talk about what we intended last week. How are you, Tom?
Good morning.
Tom, a main reason why we wanted to talk to you about North Korea is because we're all wondering what might happen. I have a 14-year-old son who flat out asked me, should I be worried about North Korea? And I said, no, you shouldn't be losing sleep about it. I feel comfortable being in Chicago and not on the coast. But what's happening? What can you tell us?
Well, you gave your son the right advice, and I would feel the same even if I were living on the coast. I think we need to take a step back here and look at this in the context of 60 years of history on the Korean Peninsula. A lot of this is theatrics that Kim Jong-un is doing for his own people. His family has constructed a mythology that they are in constant danger of a U.S.-led invasion, and that only they can protect the country. They tightly control information, access to information, and everything else. So his desire to acquire nuclear weapons is he sees it as a guarantee, an insurance policy, maybe even a bargaining chip. On the other hand, he does not wish to be annihilated.
Because that's the end result, correct?
Absolutely right. And even China has said, look, if the United States launches a preemptive strike, we'll intervene. If North Korea fires at an American target, an American ally, then we understand that there will be a response. Now, it's not in their interest to see that country annihilated or even have its leadership collapse, because it would create problems for China. So they do have significant influence there. The other thing, too, is unfortunately there's a lot of hype about this, their capability. People have strung together a lot of what-ifs. Yes, they do. They have tested long-range missiles. The accuracy of their guidance system is highly questionable. They do have a small enough nuclear explosive device to put on a warhead. It has not been tested. How well would it work? Could they deliver it? Could they get through our fairly sophisticated anti-missile defense systems? And would they actually hit the target? And even if they came close, it's very clear they would face massive retaliation.
Is there an agreement in place, Tom, by which North Korea says we will not test these missiles, or does that agreement not exist?
No, it doesn't exist. There were talks that it broke down, I want to say, somewhere around 2009, that they called six-party talks, and there have been an effort to kind of restart those. Unfortunately, you have two individuals, our president and Kim Jong-un, who are speaking to their base with this tough rhetoric talk. And unfortunately, tough rhetoric from the United States feeds right into the messaging and the mythology that Kim Jong-un is trying to propagate. It's very easy to say, well, see, I told you, look at how they're behaving and so on. I'm not confident there will even be any shots in the direction of Guam, and I'm not sure they would be able to hit it. I preface all this by saying, you know, I'm speaking as a policy analyst here. I don't have the scientific knowledge to answer precise questions about the mechanics of bomb making and ICBMs.
But Tom, he's been saying all along, Kim Jong-un has been saying from day one, the U.S. is out to get us. They have an agenda, and they want to destroy us, right? This is something he's been telling his people since he's been in office.
And his father and his grandfather before him. It's been the consistent drumbeat since the end of the Korean War in 1953. We still really do not have a peace treaty from that war. We have an armistice. So we've agreed to stop fighting in the Korean Peninsula, but there is no final peace treaty. So this is part of the Kim dynasty's rhetoric for since 53, the last 64 years. So this is nothing new in that regard. What makes it new is the weapon systems, obviously.
And we had reports that Kim Jong-un said he was going to strike Guam, a big U.S. Base there, by the end of August. And then, Bill, you and I were talking about it off the air. It's like, why would you say I'm going to do it at the end of August and not do it the next day? I mean, that's kind of what confused and worried me. Like, I don't believe him.
I don't think anyone does outside of his own country. And even then, I'm not sure. I don't believe he said he was going to strike Guam. He said he would launch missiles near Guam to prove he could hit it.
Okay.
He hasn't escalated to the point of hitting it, the Guamayan. I don't know what the word is. Nobody seems to know. Is it Guamians, Guamayans, whatever? They don't seem to be terribly agitated by this. And so on. The other good thing is despite the tough talk, and of course that's been eclipsed by the news on Afghanistan and the whole Charlottesville aftermath, but we're not forward positioning additional hardware and so on to make it look like we're about to do something. We do have military maneuvers, but those are held annually with South Korean forces, and I believe they're not near quite as big as they've been in the past either. They're just sort of routine exercises.
Tom, we can talk more about Afghanistan after the break, but I'm curious, do you find him, Kim Jong-un, to be more aggressive and potentially more dangerous than his father was?
That's really hard to say, and I'm not a Korea expert. I think he's, yes, because of his age. He seems to be more insecure. There was not quite this level of purging of people around him that may make him a bit of a wild card. It's not entirely clear whether there wouldn't be some kind of palace revolt if his generals thought he was about to start a war that would have the country, turned into a glowing parking lot. So I don't know. I really think the safety switch here is China. I mean, something like 80 to 90% of North Korea's trade is actually with China. They want him as a cat's paw. They find him useful. They don't want him to start World War III in the Pacific.
What are the odds of a discussion taking place to remove the impending doom that we're feeling?
It's already going on. One of the things that happens when you read newspaper reports is we say, well, there are no negotiations. What that means is there are no direct open sanction talks. There is always back channel communication going on. Even in wartime, there's a joke among historians that, even in wartime, enemies have to talk to each other. That's why God created Switzerland, sort of a European history thing. But the truth is that you can be sure that those conversations are taking place quietly. They just are not at the level of formal talks. Formal talks signal a much stronger intent to resolve things. But it's in everybody's interest to find a solution to this. And it does seem to be quieting down a little, but one never knows with him.
The idea that Dennis Rodman keeps making visits, is that good, bad, or does it not matter at all?
It's entertaining.
It
That's
is entertaining.
About all it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Dennis Rodman has never been, never left us with, with a source of things to be amused by. It is irrelevant to absolutely everything.
All right.
He doesn't have any particular thing there. Kim likes the attention, I'm sure, and so does Rodman. That's about it.
DePaul professor, historian, author. We'll talk about his books after the break, and we'll talk about Afghanistan. His name is Tom Mikaitis, and I have to tell you, you're kind of like my human Prozac. Every time we talk to you, I feel much more at ease. So I appreciate that.
I've been called many things, but I like that one. That's a new one. Thank you.
All right. Hang on. If you guys have questions, 312-981-7200. We'll continue talking with Tom Mikaitis. It's Bill and Wendy on 720 WGN. Tom Mikaitis, my human Prozac. I won't say that every time we speak to you, Tom.
Put it on the
I
cover
promise.
Of the book, Tom. Put it on the cover of the book.
All right, we were talking about North Korea, and someone has texted us, and before we switch into Afghanistan mode, someone has texted, Winter Olympics, 6 months away, guess where, South Korea, how will that affect everything?
Again, probably not at all. I mean, the thing to keep in mind is the North Koreans had the ability to destroy the city of Seoul just with conventional artillery. There's something like 8,000. Many of which are pointed at it and are hidden in difficult places. Even the military could not take them out before they did some substantial damage. Again, I doubt very much he would risk a crisis that would turn the entire world against him, like launching an attack during an international Olympic event.
But he doesn't always think as sanely as we do. That's the scary part, right?
I'm not sure that that's true.
No?
I'm not sure.
He wants to survive.
Yeah, he wants to survive. That's the bottom line. And again, the thing is we have a habit of, I think everyone does, of interpreting everything said about us as really about us. I think there's a domestic audience here. Obviously, he doesn't answer to an electorate, but he does have generals around him
who are rational about these sorts of things. And he does need to feed this national mythology of paranoia. So I think a lot of the bluff and bluster and even the tests are there. Another interesting thing is something like 80% of the tests have had various kinds of failures. So there's some pretty strong speculation that can't be proven that we may actually have had some hand in, you know, say computer hacking and sabotaging and so on. But again, that's a technical area. But I have read that has may in fact have been the case.
Tom, during the war of words between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, several people said, really, basically, they're not that different personality-wise. Do you find that to be true or not?
I would say, in terms of personality, I'd say in terms of rhetoric, yes, they're clearly doing the same thing. And unfortunately, their rhetoric feeds off each other. It adds to the escalation. Because in a sense, the extreme response by President Trump in terms of the war of words just, emboldens Kim to go further. And it also feeds into, the "see, I told you so," America really is hostile. We have no choice but to prepare to defend ourselves.
And switching gears a little bit, on Monday night, President Donald Trump reversed his past calls for a speedy exit in Afghanistan, recommended the United States add what is being reported now as 3,900 additional troops. Let's just end this war once and for all. What are your thoughts on this?
Again, it's a formula for continued failure. I mean, I think he himself is not happy with this. There have been numerous generals who've commented and said this seems to be the least bad of a bunch of bad options. But what concerns me, and he said, we're not there to do nation building. We're there merely to kill terrorists. That's a contradiction in terms. This really is not a terrorist campaign. It's an insurgency. The Taliban are not fighting to promote jihad around the world. They're fighting to regain control of Afghanistan. And they're succeeding in large measure because of a corrupt and largely illegitimate government in Kabul that was seen to have been put in place by the United States and its allies and has very little credibility and not a whole lot of reach into the countryside. The other thing to keep in mind, we're going to equip and train and support. We've been doing that for 16 years. If they haven't done it, if they haven't got it by now, are they really going to get better with another mere 3,900 people? And what price in blood and treasure are we prepared to pay for that? There does come a time in which you stop doubling down on a bad bet. Say, you know what? We contain this. We put a fence around it. We monitor. We do incursions if they do anything outside of Afghanistan. But loathsome as they are, we can't win somebody else's hearts and minds or win their war for them.
One of his campaign promises, President Trump's campaign promises, was to obliterate ISIS. Is that at all realistic?
Which ISIS are we talking about? I mean, that's the kind of question. There's no doubt that ISIS in the Middle East is going to be destroyed, the Islamic State, meaning that it will lose control of the territory it has held since about the spring of 2014. But as we saw last week in Barcelona, there is a network of ISIS supporters, adherents, and even lone wolf just tag-alongs all over the world prepared to continue to struggle this. This is an ideological struggle. ISIS is drinking from the same, well of inspiration as Al-Qaeda. This jihadist, Salafist kind of philosophy of radical Islam that, that others will espouse. So, they're the latest emanation. But that larger threat isn't going to go away. So, yeah, ISIS is being squeezed and constrained. The more we do that, ironically, the more the attacks occur farther abroad.
And finally, before we let you go, we had talked earlier this morning about President Donald Trump has his finger on the nuclear button, but there are checks and balances that keep this from happening. How do these checks and balances work, and are they in place?
Well, I have to do a fair amount of speculating here because I do not have a security clearance, and I think I'm sure how exactly it works is a pretty closely guarded secret. But there is no button. The idea that the guy that follows him around, the military officer with what's called a football, which is the briefcase with the launch codes, you don't open it up and there's a great big red button you push and a whole bunch of nukes go off. There's a protocol and a system, and there are probably cutoffs, meaning there are places in which it could be stopped. And I think, again, the military leaders would, in fact, probably balk at being given an order that they consider to be illegal, unconstitutional, or likely to start World War III. I don't really think that you know, that's a high probability thing. The president even, you know, is showing, I mean, for example, one thing is good about the Afghan speech the other night is he stayed on script and he obviously was following the instructions of his generals, you know, because it was very uncharacteristically subdued Donald Trump laying out a pot he wasn't terribly thrilled with.
So, Tom, that scene that we've seen in every movie where the president puts a key in and then a general, high ranking general puts a key in and then Oprah puts a key in and they all have to turn it at the same time. That's just in the movies. That's not real, right?
There's some variety of multiple key approaches, but I don't know. What you've seen in the movie is actually down in the missile silos. You have in a Minuteman squadron, you'll have in a particular launch site, you have two men in the silo having to simultaneously turn the keys, and there has to be a verified order and all that. How specifically it goes from the commander in chief down, and what happens if he's removed because of a strike on Washington or something. It's much more complicated than the movies, I can assure you of that.
I always feel much better after speaking to Tom Mikaitis.
Human Prozac, Wendy. That's what people are calling him.
If people
want that on the cover of my next book. Wendy calls this Human Prozac.
All right. Where do we find you in all your books? Where's the best place to locate you?
Oh, Amazon's got most of them. You just Google my name under there, and I'm working on another one on terrorism. And I also blog for the Huffington Post, too, on more current sorts of things.
Awesome. Can't wait to speak to you again.
Well, be careful what you wish for, because it's never good when you...
Yeah,
that's true.
I guess that's right.
Very true. We hope to never talk to you again, Tom.
And I won't take that personally.
Excellent. Right. Good. Thank you. It's Tom Mikaitis, everybody. We'll take a quick break, then some news, then more show. Bill and Wendy, WGN.